Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Rick Moody, whose new book, Hotels of North America, has recently been published by Little Brown. This is, to my mind, a truly strange and funny book, but so remorseful and sad that its enormous and kind of ebullient mean humor is kneed in the groin by the sadness of the narrator, who has realized that he's really failed in every aspect of his life. Now, having no home, no wife, out of touch with his child, having lost his girlfriend, he wanders from hotel to hotel in North America, writing reports about hotels, not the hotels he's in that night, but the hotels he once stayed in when he was a little bit happier, when there was something to live for. Oh, Rick. don't you like to give us something to live for?
Well, I'm hoping that the language is such as to provide some entertainment as a cross current against the woe of this poor guy. That's the idea, that a few jokes hopefully can, and the richness of the descriptive language can serve as a...
And the rhythm.
A tonic, yeah.
He's got not just a lot of Rick Moody's rhythms, but I recognize here some of the rhythms of your one-time teacher mentor, John Hawkes, the rhythmic repetitions of someone whose prose owed a lot to the sound of poetry.
Mm.
The book keeps mentioning people who once majored in English literature and have gone off to become motivational speakers or workers in the financial field. The book is very much haunted by the ghost of what it once meant to be a liberal arts major and to find that there's no place in the world for you, liberal arts major. And this is the first of the many failures that the narrator, Reginald Edward Morse, he remembers the days when they sent taxis to take him home from work when he was in finances.
Mm. Yeah.
This is the story of a complete dissipation, yeah?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, he certainly has alcoholism, and that becomes a problem and results in gaps in the text. The text is sort of encoded to have gaps and disjunctions that are the signs of his difficulties in that area. But also, Michael, it bears mentioning that to me, we leave out a register if we don't speak to the fact of his writing being an online practice as opposed to a more conventional publication or what have you. So that, at least from my point of view, his disaffiliation is emblematic for the fact that he's a writer of the online variety. And that online culture is of a particular estrangement.
Yes, we sometimes are crouched over his shoulder as he's alone in a hotel room having computer sex with a man in the Philippines, and they're both pretending to be something other than they are. Reginald is completely straight. The Filipino is talking about his need to know that he's turning on his listener, and yet we know that Reginald is sitting there with his head in his hands just trying to distract himself from the environment he's in, what used to be called any place but here, Baudelaire's phrase, that there's a real sense that there is no place to be that isn't alien.
Yeah.
Why?
So I was trying to write a conventionally structured realistic novel. That was my task that I set myself in 2009. And the reason I did it was because I had written two comic novels and I felt like I had depleted that material. And so as I approached this book, my aesthetic idea was that it would have no jokes. So I embarked on trying to write a book that had no jokes, and I wrote 250 pages of it. And I experienced revulsion at my own project. And at that time, my wife Laurel and I were staying in Bergen, Norway, in a very abjectly bad hotel that had house music Friday and Saturdays. You know, so I was up at 2 listening to boom-chi, 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 and Laurel said, let's review this hotel. And so I set about the project of trying to do that, write an actual hotel review, which I never published. But it occurred to me at that moment that online hotel reviews were more accurate as illustrations of where we are culturally than trying to write a conventionally canted realistic novel of, you know, early mid-20th century variety.
What he's doing is not reviewing hotels of North America. He's reviewing life and his sense that when you lose your home and find yourself dependent on the second home, the home of the hotel, that you will never have a home again, that you're living spontaneously and desperately. Now, the extraordinary thing that happens in the strange ordering of the book is that he meets a woman who is first called Kay, K-A-Y, and then referred to as Kay, initial K as in Kafka. And she likes to wander from place to place as much as he does. And so the final pages of the book look like a happy ending. He's met his match, however strange that match is. But in fact...
Yeah, it's otherwise because of the order of the pieces. You have to be... You have to really be on your toes to get it. And that's in part why I included these end papers that have a bit of a graph for which stay goes where. Because if you read carefully, you realize that at the end of the book, he's on a serious downturn, probably another relapse. And maybe his relationship with Kay is in arrears at that moment.
I'm talking to Rick Moody about his new book, Hotels of North America. So he's met the perfect person for him. But tell me, Rick, she seems to have all sorts of difficulties with environments that are unfamiliar to her.
So true. I mean, you're speaking in part about There's a very long bed passage where she can't get comfortable with any bed that they have. Yeah. I think he superficially believes that he's met his match, but as the thing bears fruit, it appears perhaps that she's quite a bit more complicated than he originally supposed.
Her world is not so much the world of hotel rooms. It's the world of hotel corridors and hotel ballrooms. Mm. Because during this tour, and we accompany these two from the end of the book back through the earlier sections. I read the book twice. If we read it in the order that the end pages suggest, we're going to read about the dating, the first marriage of, the divorce of, the sad results of the divorce, the meeting with Kay, a travel tour in which Kay takes on various bird names. She's sometimes called Swallow or Chickadee or
Sparrow, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Starling, maybe.
Yeah. And it's because she likes to fly, she likes to dance, she likes to move on her feet. And I thought I'd ask you to read a section, possibly the climax of their happiness, that takes place at the Davenport Hotel and Tower at 10 South Post Street in Spokane, Washington, from April 4th to the 7th in 2011. This is Rick Moody reading from Hotels of North America.
We didn't know much about Spokane, except in a general way how to pronounce Spokane. We didn't know about the waterfalls downtown and the bridges, and we didn't know that Spokane is surrounded by a resting countryside. The Pacific Northwest stuff. Conifers, skeins of fog, snow on the peaks. We arrived at the Davenport just a couple months after the Martin Luther King Day attempted bombing in Spokane. And so the Davenport Hotel was incredibly empty. The Davenport, it's accurate to say, is one of the most beautiful hotels in the lower 48. It may be one of the most beautiful hotels in the entire world. Were you to discount hotels that are constructed primarily to house sheikhs, hotels that will never house you or me, you would have to conclude that this was a truly remarkable place. There's gilded everything inside and potted palms, but it's the ballrooms that are outrageous. And while we were staying there, Snowy Owl, as she was called on this trip, and I, you could just walk into these totally empty ballrooms, because how often in Spokane were the ballrooms in use, and gape at their magnificence. What I'm really driving at here is that the Davenport is the hotel where Snowy Owl and I began to collect our sequence of films of Snowy Owl running and dancing in public places and in extremely long corridors. The bliss of dancing in a long hotel corridor is to be found in the fact that you know you're showing up on someone's camera somewhere. There's not a chance that at any moment you could be asked to discontinue it. There was a very long corridor in the Davenport, that is true, but it was nothing compared to its Hall of the Doges. I don't really know what a doge is. Some kind of magistrate in Venice, perhaps. But I do know that the name has the right kind of seriousness about it. And when we opened the door to the Hall of the Doges, Kay was unable not to dance across it. Kay was a dancer as a young person, and she can still jump pretty high. And even though she has a few injuries of the sort that a person is liable to have when approaching true middle age, she just threw her jacket a hoodie of some kind, on the floor of the entirely empty hall of the Doges, and began dancing into the center of the room irrepressibly. Did I know yet that this moment would describe everything we were going to be, the kind of people who would find it important to dance in hotels, and especially to dance in hotels when otherwise besieged by the worst of circumstances?
Rick Moody, reading from Hotels of North America. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Rick Moody about his latest book, Hotels of North America, an innovative novel using online hotel reviews to tell just enough of a story to create an intriguing protagonist.
I would say Reginald, I would argue, is the best single character I've ever created, the most real, the most lifelike, the most that I've ever felt at the end of a book, I could imagine the guy walking in the room and I would know who it was. More so than in The Ice Storm, more so than in Purple America. Because in those books, I created landscape first and then I would people it after the fact. But in this book, there's no landscape. The landscape is the non-actualization of landscape. So the character had to be there first. His voice was there.
We hear his voice. It's an extraordinary voice because it is a mixture of high and low. He knows and seems to have deserved resentment of people who go to places like Harvard or people who can stay in hotels that were not built for people like you and me. But he seems at the same time to have had an education that's given him a vocabulary that would be useless except when he's writing highfalutin hotel reviews. So he's found a use for his voice. But whose voice is that, Rick? Who is he?
I mean, who is the person who can write that well about a hotel?
Yeah.
I mean, I like your idea that he's a sort of ghost from the era of liberal arts. I think that's a really beautiful thought, you know. I mean, I know, I'm sure you know, plenty. The world is heavily peopled with great thinkers about the literary arts, the arts in general, who have no application for their genius. Nowadays, that and 275 and you ride on the subway, you know. So
do you feel that as a novelist?
Up to a point, I do. And I see it happening around me. I've been incredibly lucky, but the literature that I loved, the literature that you often talk about on this show, you know, has a use value in a community of great tininess, shrinkage. It's getting smaller by the year, you know. I continue on because of passion for it. But I don't know how other people, I don't know how younger people continue on with it.
And like the characters in special novels, Humbert Humbert, say, and the person who writes the introduction to Humbert's book, Lolita, John Ray Jr., J.R.J.R. Reginald Edward Morse is R.E. Morse. Remorse, it's revealed by a aging, dying ballerina in the afterwards. She has a name that comes close to morose, and she points out that your name is Moody. Now, how does it come to be, Rick Moody, that you appear in this novel?
You know, you've sort of hit the nail right on the head by invoking Nabokov, though I thought that the Touchstone book, and maybe even by saying that it has Hawks's rhythms in it, you're also alluding to a similar condition, because Hawks, of course, was so besotted with Nabokov.
This is John Hawks, who was once Rick Moody's writing teacher and one of the great ears in American literature.
But he pointed me, in fact, in the direction of Pale Fire, which was a, you know, a sort of a bomb blast in my undergraduate consciousness. Pale Fire, a novel by Nabokov that's structured as a poem in four cantos. Is it four? I think it's four. And
rhyming couplets.
Yeah, rhyming couplets. And introduction and end notes by Shade's alleged literary executor.
A crazy novel.
Yeah. Beautiful, luminous, unslayable. You can read it 10 times. It still yields up some new approach. But what the book does is structurally, formally, completely prevent the kind of realistic effect of American naturalism.
Yes, I get it. I felt like I was reading about another world, and that he was traveling, your character, from one version of this other world to another, the hotel world, the world for loners who need one another and can't speak to one another, who hate meeting each other at breakfast, especially in B&Bs. So let's get to it. You, Rick Moody, are called upon by the rate you're lodging folk to edit a collection of Reginald Morse's hotel ratings.
Yeah. And they offer me $300 to do it, which in the book I'm very happy to have those $300. And I mean, you know that the Rick Moody in the afterword bears no resemblance to the one sitting in the interview today, because his prose style is blunt, unaffected, has very short sentences. So I wanted, on the one hand, to invent a Rick Moody who was so ludicrously not the Rick Moody that from the outset, the afterword as an engagement would seem to be utterly artificial. What that Rick Moody does is become so preoccupied with trying to establish the truth value of Reginald Morse that he can never really adequately perform his task as writer of afterword or evaluator of the work itself.
Now, if I venture a bit of interpretation.
I've never known you to do otherwise.
Well, I will do my best. I found the book very frightening because it seemed to me to be about someone who can neither conduct a marriage, be a child, have an affair successfully. Fidelity seems impossible. Sobriety is something. It's coded again. You know, he talks about needing to rehabilitate. And it's never brought into focus what this rehabilitation would involve. But it seems to be a book about a person perfectly capable, say, of standing up to speak movingly at a 12th step meeting while being incapable of living a life.
Yeah, I don't dispute that at all. That is who he is. And I've known a multitude with this particular diagnosis. And what I have often come away with is that I love when they talk. And Reg is a guy, I hope he is in my view, one of those who can open his mouth and dazzle. I mean, someone was telling me about that article in the Times. Did you see this article about how the suicide rate among middle-aged, middle-class white people right now is the highest in the nation of any group and increasing? And nobody has an explanation for it. A psychiatrist friend came to me and said, do you think it's historical? We were born at this certain moment that was of such devastation, by which I think she means the counterculture and the aftermath of the counterculture, that we can never get back. You know, we're lost. But I don't think it's that exactly. And yet it's indisputable.
Wow. You know what I think it is, though?
It's
an odd way of wording it, but what other way is there? It's that the end of the world is coinciding with the end of a world, and we're simultaneously seeing that the world itself, its water, its nature, its heat, its temperature, is coinciding with the end of the cultural mores we once knew and thought of as permanent, the reading of novels, the formation of marriages, the centrality of family. And it's very hard to have this much stuff coming to an end all at the same time, while somehow or other a technology is being born that is reviewing the end of several kinds of worlds. And the people familiar with that technology have grown up with the end of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and they don't even necessarily see it that way. They see it otherwise, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right.
I've been talking with Rick Moody. I think he's right, too. Author of Hotels of North America, published by Little Brown and Company. Thank you, Rick, for joining me.
Thanks, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when we discuss the selected poems of John Wieners.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.